for April 21st, 2016. It's the Lullabot Podcast. It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 185. I'm Matt Cleave, a senior developer with Lullabot. With me, my co-host, Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Matt.
Mike's a front-end dev at Lullabot, too. So
that is correct.
I guess the common thread is that we do Drupal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Today, we're talking about a very important topic when it comes to Drupal, Drupal security.
Yes. Everything's, security is important, and it's kind of topical, too.
We'll be doing the safety dance all the way through it. So with us, we brought on a couple of people from the Drupal community who know a thing or two about Drupal security. First, I'll introduce our first guest. He works at card.com, where he helps with website development, analytics, and infrastructure. He is the former Drupal security team lead, formerly of Growing Venture Solutions and Acquia. He's a contributor to modules such as PathAuto, Token, and Paranoia. He's known as Greggles on Drupal.org and Twitter. He was my introduction to the Drupal community, and he's been on Drupal.org for over 10 years. From Denver, Colorado, Greg Knadison. How you doing?
Whoa, hello!
That's such a rock star introduction. Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, we try to maximize these. So next, this person works at the University of Michigan School of Information and also the UM Medical Center, teaching three courses on content management platforms. He oversees hundreds of UM websites. He is the current lead of the Drupal security team, ML Hess on Drupal.org, and he's been involved with Drupal for a very long time. According to Drupal.org, your first DrupalCon was in 2008. Welcome, Michael Hess.
Hi, all.
Hey, Michael. Security, I guess. I think before we get too far, when somebody talks about security, what is kind of the, what definition do we use? Let's, before we get too far, when we define security, what do we mean?
I think that the definition that I like is called the security triad. And it includes confidentiality, availability, and integrity. So I think that covers, three big areas of what many people consider to be security. And, you know, it's a little abstract, but yeah, confidentiality, availability, and integrity.
I normally agree with Greg on everything. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, our risk calculator is based off of that principle to some extent. So yes, the triad makes sense to me. Confidentiality is kind of like privacy for some, to describe it. It's the data that's supposed to be private remains private. And integrity is, can the people who update it, who are supposed to be able to update it, and availability is somewhat obvious.
So what's the difference between confidentiality and availability? Because honestly, it's not as obvious to me, because availability means, I would assume means available to the correct people and not available to the people who should not get access to it.
I think availability is a bit like keeping the site online. So it's more from the perspective of like highly available. So redundant resources serving up the infrastructure, things like that.
Understandable. Awesome.
So I guess an attack that would affect that would be like a denial of service or distributed denial of service attack.
Now that makes a lot more sense. Yes.
Okay. Cool. So you guys, we mentioned Michael, the head of the Drupal security team. Greg, you were the former Drupal security team lead. If you don't mind talking about the Drupal security team, how that works within the community and what happens there.
For sure. So my understanding, and while I've been involved with Drupal a long time, it's not since the beginning, but my understanding is that basically in about 2005, Charlie Nagyessi said, "Hey, Dries, how come we don't have security at Drupal.org for security issues?" And Dries said, "That's a good idea." And so they got together about 20 people who, were talented contributors and sort of knowledgeable about security, and put them all on a mailing list together. And it started out somewhat informally between IRC and the mailing list. And then about a year later, maybe year two, three, something like that, Charlie stepped away from being the security team lead, but of course was very involved, and Heine Delstra stepped into that role. And one of the things that Heine did was to create the security.drupal.org website, I think along with Boris Mann, perhaps. There's an issue tracker and bugs got submitted and coordinated there. That's really the beginning of the security team. Up through then, you know, I became the Drupal security team lead and served in that role for 2 years. And, now the, team is even more formal. It's up to over, I think, 40 people from, different parts of the world. And then past on Michael Hess has been security team lead for a while now. It's a much more formal organization than back in 2005, much like so many things in Drupal are more formal than they once were.
So how often does the security team communicate with each other? What does that look like? I mean, is it all through some type of private issue queue? Is it via email, some private Slack channel, or what do you do?
So we're on a combination of private email list, IRC, not Slack, and private issue tracker.
Yeah.
So we'll handle security issues on the private issue tracker and coordinate with both the reporters of the private issues and the maintainers of the code that potentially has a security issue in it. And then we have kind of operational chat on IRC and, this is interesting. Did you see this? That type of stuff on IRC. And then the email list is for more widespread, discussions, adding new members, dealing with, do we want to change this policy? Should we change this policy? And we also handle some of that stuff in public on drupal.org/project/security/drupal.org, all one word, the issue tracker on that module, which is one place where we have some public discussions along with bugs in security.drupal.org. So it gets a little intertwined there.
So how busy are you guys on a day-to-day basis? Are there security bugs that are found on a day-to-day basis? Is this something like, a couple times a week? How much time goes into this?
It's somewhat up to the individual team member. For Michael and I would say that every day we're, at least reading some information about reported security issues. I think last year there were about 160 security advisories that went out over the course of the year. Mm-hmm. And if you assume that there's some amount of triage of either duplicate submissions or invalid submissions, then you can, sort of get a sense that basically every day there's at least one or slightly less than one issue being reported to the team that needs to be triaged and handled.
That makes a lot of sense. I subscribe to the mailing list, and so I see the notifications come out, and I see a lot of notifications come out for just contrib modules and stuff, and a lot of them are kind of funny too, because from my point of view, it's a lot of it is if you have admin rights to, I think it was something with features, you can enable something else. A lot of it is kind of funny. From the reason I think it's funny is because if you're already an admin, you can already screw up the site pretty well. But at the same time, I'm sure there are edge cases where maybe you have roles and everything is separated out. So I just find that kind of interesting.
I think it's sort of a tricky question about which items should get a security advisory and which ones don't. And we have a policy that defines exactly what it is. So it has to do with the permission, the nature of that permission, and whether for Drupal 7 and above, whether it's marked as a restrict access equals true in the permission definition. But basically, if the nature of the permission is that you can take over the site, then we don't report a security vulnerability that requires that permission. In the case of administering features, it's like, you could do a lot of damage, but the purpose of the permission is not to be able to take over the site, versus something like administer users where, you can, change roles, change permissions, change all sorts of stuff.
And just to clarify, the Drupal security team is looking at contributed code, contributed modules, contributed themes, and Drupal core.
That's right. And even within that, it's a bit of a subset of just contributed modules that have had a full stable release. So it's not even all contributed modules. It's also only stuff that's hosted on Drupal.org. So if a module is hosted elsewhere, then you know, we're interested in the security of it, but we won't announce an advisory for it.
A full stable release, meaning like not a, a dev or not a, a
beta.
Yeah, RC1 beta. Yeah.
Exactly.
We have a 1.0
yeah,
or
that's
or
pretty beta. Interesting. So, and everything that's not on Drupal.org does not fall. So Drush is, I believe, pretty much done on GitHub now. So that would not fall under the umbrella. Is that
nope.
correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
Security's been in the news a little bit with the Panama Papers. I'm sure you guys have heard. There's been a little bit of, conjecture. The organization that had the papers leaked from them had both some WordPress and Drupal sites. Both of WordPress and Drupal were, I guess, hideously out of date, including, I think it was 7.22 was the version of Drupal that they were currently running by the time someone looked. And as you guys, I'm sure, know, that's a long time before the Drupal-geddon bug got fixed. So I think that's kind of interesting. I don't really know if there's anything else to say about that, but do you have any thoughts on that? Or, I mean, except for keep your sites updated.
Keep your sites up to date. Yeah. If you've got people's confidential information, you probably should be hiring someone to help you with keeping everything updated, because it's not just your sites. I'm sure the servers running those sites probably weren't patched either. I think I read someplace that their mail server wasn't doing things correctly. I think there were a lot of things from a security perspective with that company that had some issues.
So if you read the headline, it might have said that Drupal was at fault, but chances are probably not Drupal's fault if Drupal wasn't updated, and we don't actually even know if the papers came from the Drupal website. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of guessing, and we may never know what the public at large may never know what the true path was to taking the information outside of the organization. My understanding is that it was a fairly sizable amount of data on the order of 2 terabytes. And so the idea that the attacker would exfiltrate, to use the word that people use in this situation, I don't know why it's got to be such a big word, but exfiltrate the data.
That's a good word. I like it.
It's in order to do that over a network connection, like, you're making a pretty serious commitment. So it seems just as likely to me that a disgruntled employee or a social engineer in person walked into the data center and like took a copy of a hard drive and just walked out the door with a hard drive. That seems like an equally plausible explanation for what happened. It could have been, there was a WordPress vulnerability that had remote code execution in a WordPress plugin. As Michael and Mike mentioned, I think the mail server was misconfigured. I think another interesting point about this is that it appears that there wasn't sufficient defense in depth. And what I mean by that is just a separation of the resources. So if you have some very sensitive documents, you should store those separately from your brochureware public facing site. You should have, you know, all of your resources isolated from each other as much as you can, so that when somebody's accessing your WordPress blog, they don't have the ability from a vulnerability there to get access to additional resources.
And that's good advice for, you know, almost all sites, is that you should isolate, you know, processes. You should isolate by sensitivity level, and if you can, by site. A lot of companies I've seen here at Michigan, we've done it, you know, we'll set up a Linux box and run as many sites on it as they can. And most times I can compromise one of those sites and use that as a access point to get data in other sites. So while, you know, group A may have an insecure site and group B may have the most secure site in the world, if they're running on shared hardware with shared accounts for access, I can compromise one to get to the other.
So how does that work with cloud computing? I mean, there's plenty of cloud computing environments for Drupal. I know Acquia hosts, I think, on Amazon. Pantheon, I believe, hosts on Rackspace. How does that come into play?
It would depend on their specific installations. You know, I'm sure that Acquia and Pantheon, and I don't want to comment directly on either, are doing things the right way and, you know, have isolations of resources where appropriate. I think Acquia spins up a VM per site or an EC2 instance, and Pantheon, I think, is doing containerization for every site. So they are appropriately isolating resources on a site-by-site basis.
Yeah, I think that virtualization technologies, whether it's virtual machines or containers, are really exciting from the perspective of security, since they allow you to use resources more efficiently and isolate things. Of course, it's important to keep the management of them separate, keep credentials separate, things like that, so that compromising one container doesn't mean that you've compromised others, right?
So you mentioned keeping your Drupal sites, keeping your Drupal, Drupal code, Drupal modules up to date is certainly important. What does that mean now that Drupal 6 has come end to life? What is the status of that as far as Drupal security is concerned?
That's a tricky point. How do you keep things up to date if there aren't new releases? I think, that the official volunteer community support for Drupal 6 ended when it was, basically 3 months after Drupal 8 being released. And that's what the Drupal community has done for a long time. It's what a lot of other software platforms do they can only maintain community level of interest in a certain number of releases. And the Drupal community has said it's the current one and the one before. So with the release of Drupal 8, there was actually a slightly longer period where Drupal 6 was supported for 3 months after Drupal 8 was released. And I think in the future that we'll see even more overlap like that. But I don't think that it will ever get to the point where the two versions ago version is supported sort of indefinitely, right? Like Drupal 6 had a really long life compared to most web software, and it was sort of time for it to move on. However, there is, we created a structure for long-term support of Drupal 6. And what we tried to do was make sure that we were balancing the need for those long-term support people to have a sustainable business model with Drupal's strong value on making things accessible to the community, making software accessible to the community. So there are a set of long-term supporting vendors that people who have a Drupal 6 site can contract with them in order to get support for their site. And those vendors have committed that when they release a patch for a Drupal 6 issue to one of their customers, they will release it on Drupal.org at the same instant. So the public is getting the patch, whether or not they are paying one of those vendors, at the same time that the paid supporting organizations are getting that patch. Now, what the paid people can get in addition is some additional services. So they can get additional advice, perhaps, or they can have the updates applied directly. Some of the different long-term support vendors are doing different additional services to provide value for their customers. If you have a Drupal 6 site, I really encourage people to look at those support options and consider them. I think that some of them are very reasonably priced, and it's important that there's a sustainable business model there.
I think people with Drupal 6 sites, the advice I'm giving out at the university is you really need to figure out what your upgrade plans are, because even the long-term support model is not going to be, long-term is as long as it's financially viable to the companies providing it. But also, PHP itself is going to change. And at some point, the versions that Drupal 6 runs on from PHP won't be supported by the PHP community. And so, at some point, you need to update your site and put in the time and the resources to do so. But if you've got to run one short term, then please do reach out to one of the long-term support vendors. If you Google Drupal 6 long-term support vendors, they're easy to find on Drupal.org. And if you've got a relationship with one of them already, all the better.
Michael, if you don't mind, I think we might have jumped ahead here. If you could just real quickly take us through a reported exploit when it comes into the security team, and then the process that happens after that.
Sure. So typically what will happen is a security researcher, sometimes a module maintainer themselves, or a user of a module will come to the Drupal security team, and they'll go to the project page of the module. And on every project page on Drupal.org, there's a link to report a security vulnerability. And when you click on that, you'll basically be presented with the normal create an issue form that you're somewhat used to. It's got some different fields on it. and you'll describe what the security vulnerability is. And once that comes in, someone from the Drupal security team will read it and make a decision whether or not there's some validity in what it says. And if it sounds like it's a valid report, we'll invite the module maintainers to read it and give us some suggestions on what's going on there. Is this a valid issue? And if so, then the module maintainer will create a patch for the issue. Someone on the security team will read over the patch and verify that it works. If the reporter of the issue is willing to, we let them test the patch. We'll let them test the patch. And then we write the security advisory, which is what you end up seeing on the Wednesday emails. And so typically the module maintainer helps write that. And then we choose a Wednesday to actually create the release and distribute the security advisory.
Releases happen on Wednesdays, and that's every Wednesday for contributed stuff.
And core as well.
Core as well. And there has been something that's happened fairly recently about core release windows and that kind of thing. Can you explain that?
So the core release, we've always had a security core release window on Wednesday. That I think that's always, as long as I can remember, we've done releases for it. There's some discussion within the core groups on moving non-security releases to a larger framework of time, just because coordinating a security or coordinating a core release is, takes a lot of people. But this core, the security releases are going to remain on Wednesday.
So with Drupal 8 now being the new hotness, Drupal 8 is very different when compared to Drupal 7. And one of those in one of those ways that is different is external libraries. So Drupal 8 brings some Symfony components. Drupal 8 has a couple of JavaScript frameworks in it. When it comes to security issues and those things, how does that get handled?
So we've reached out to the Symfony project, and we will coordinate with them on security releases for Drupal, because Drupal at the moment, at least, is bundling all the Symfony components in its download, in the tarball you download. And so we coordinate with Symfony, but you know it does add a layer of complexity to doing security releases, because it's not, you know, in the past when Drupal was written by the entirely by the Drupal community, or 80% by the Drupal, 95% by the Drupal community, you know, it was just, you know, we could go through our processes and everybody was aware of what our processes were. And so, you know, Symfony's been very receptive to working with us on this, and they're working with a couple of their other projects. So we'll see how it goes. I think we've actually already done, I think we actually had, I don't remember what the issue was, but there was an issue in Symfony where we kind of went through the, it was before Drupal 8 was released, but we actually went through the mechanics of doing a security release together, even though we didn't issue an SA for it because there wasn't a stable release of Drupal at that point, and that seemed to work well.
That's pretty smart. So between Drupal 7 and Drupal 8, I know there's a lot of security features in Drupal 8. I know Twig does auto-escaping. What else does Drupal 8 bring to the table from a security standpoint?
So I'm actually going to take a step back and focus on that auto-escaping for a second. If you go through the security advisories, the most common vulnerability we find in Drupal is cross-site scripting. Mm-hmm. People forgetting to filter their output, and thus attackers being able to execute JavaScript. So the fact that Twig has auto-escape enabled is absolutely awesome.
So can you, just for our listeners, can you explain exactly what cross-site scripting is, like what that looks like when you put the JavaScript in, I guess, a form field and it comes out versus, say, a SQL injection versus anything else?
Sure. So cross-site scripting is a little, it's a little complex. SQL injections, for the most part, are very easy because I can basically put data into a form field or into a, or inject data into the page somehow, and somehow I get that data, I get a query to run on the database. And that query runs as whatever permission Drupal has, which is typically everything to the database. So if I can get a query to run, I can do things like change passwords, update email addresses. And that's a little bit what we saw in SA05 or Drupal Get It. That is what we saw in SA05. Cross-site scripting requires a little bit more work. I'll give you an example. Let's say I've got an academic site where I allow users to write a profile page. And so we ask some questions, and they get to fill in their profile page. One of the things that a user could do would be to write in a write some JavaScript code in their profile. And when they save their profile, Drupal should not let them use the full HTML filter because, well, we don't trust our users for the most part. And so what a user could do is they could say, hey, I'm going to write this this bad JavaScript code in here, and then I'm going to email someone I know has administrative privileges and tell them to look at my profile page and tell me what I did wrong. And so a student could fill out a profile page and send me an email saying, hey, Michael, can you look at my profile page? And they're betting on the fact that I'm going to already be logged into the website with administrative privileges. And so when I pull up their profile page, that JavaScript runs as my privilege level, which would be admin in this instance. And they could do things like steal my session cookies or change passwords, all sorts of fun things with JavaScript you can do. You typically see this in security team demos as someone getting the browser to pop up a little window that says hello. They'll write like, you know, window.alert or alert hello or hi or something along those lines. And that's kind of the proof of concept that you can run JavaScript. And mm-hmm. if you run JavaScript, then you can do some pretty nasty things to somebody's site, assuming you can trick somebody into running that JavaScript code.
I think, you know, one thing that's interesting about cross-site scripting that I think is often overlooked is that, you know, basically what it allows you to do is run code as another user. So if that other user is not a privileged user, then you can, you know, take advantage of them, to whatever they can do on the site. So if it's voting for something, you can get them to initiate votes. If it's, you know, on a bank website, for example, you could get them to transfer money to a specific account. And it's also not just about JavaScript. So JavaScript is one vector, but it could be any kind of script. So, you know, Java, Flash, even though, you know, I think we see those technologies used less and less these days, but any kind of technology that can sit in somebody's browser and make requests to the server on their behalf with the cookies going along for the ride, that's really the important piece of what constitutes a cross-site scripting attack.
So how does Twig auto-escaping work? Does it have kind of a whitelist of alphanumeric characters that it can go through? Does it remove brackets? Does it have kind of a blacklist of certain types of characters that it doesn't allow?
I looked at this for a long time the other day, and I'm pretty sure that it involves unicorns and rainbows.
Sounds like a magical place.
You have to flag the item. You basically, so in using Twig, or well, in Drupal 8, or I'm sorry, Drupal 7, you could do like print $variable, and it would just print the contents of that. In Drupal 8, you basically have to specify, I do not want this to be escaped. So it's going to assume it should escape everything by default.
So outside of Twig auto escape, any other security features that Drupal 8 has?
Yeah, sure. One of my favorites is the PHP filter is now out of core.
What? Next thing you're going to tell me, they're going to remove overlay.
you know, the other thing that's in there that's a little bit less, that's kind of nice is we have CSRF token protections that can be kind of put in automatically. I think there was a sandbox module that did that in Drupal 7. And if you didn't want to do it through the sandbox module, you could write code that did it, but it's now part of the routing system in Drupal 8.
So what is a CSRF? That's cross-site forgery request, is that right?
Request forgery.
What exactly is that?
So let's see if I can explain. So, you know, we had an exploit of it here actually at the university is, you know, in the old days when you wrote PHP code, you might have a page called delete.php, and you'd pass delete.php an ID number. Mm-hmm. And it would basically take that ID number and delete it from the database. And so you could basically create a site and do something like, you know, img src=your.url/delete.php?ID=1, and then, you know, basically repeat that image and increment the IDs a bunch, and then get somebody to visit it. And when it tried to load the image, it obviously wouldn't be able to load an image, but it would basically call that URL and delete the data from the database. And, you know, in Drupal 7, when you try to delete a node, you'll notice that it doesn't just delete it. It comes up with a page and says, hey, do you want to confirm this? Mm-hmm. So that's one way around cross-site request forgeries. The other way is to put a token in the URL. And you'll see this a lot with AJAX requests, where you'll see a long random collection of letters and numbers at the end of the URL that changes. And so what's happening is we, you know, in Drupal 7, it's Drupal get token and Drupal set token. I think those are the right ones. That, you know, generate these tokens, and you basically verify that they're there before you perform any actions, and they're generated when the link gets generated.
And the important thing about those tokens is, and those tokens are used inside of the form API. And that's what, you know, inside of the form API, that's the magic of a confirm form providing protection for this. What they do is they combine together information that is private to the website, private to the user session, and specific to the action that is being taken. And so by combining those three pieces of information, there's no way that an attacker could come up with the same hash and then trick you into taking an action. Because the attacker might be able to figure out, you know, what is the piece of information that's unique to the action that's being taken, but they don't know your session ID and they don't know what's private to the site. So they can't really trick you into taking the action.
We're talking with Greg Kanatison and Michael Hess. They're actually going to be talking at DrupalCon New Orleans. They're giving a session called Watch the Hacker Hack, which I'm looking forward to. We'll talk more about that coming up right after this.
Yo, yo.
Hey. It's developer and trainer Will Hetherington from Drupalize Me. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Matt.
You know, everybody tells me that you're the guy to talk to when it comes to the Migrate series that Drupalize Me is working on.
Yeah, I'm certainly spearheading that. Joe Schindler's been helping me lots with that, of course. But yeah, I've been working fairly closely with Mike Ryan over the last little while, getting that ready for Drupal 8.1.
So I understand that there, as far as Migrate goes, there were some major changes that happened between Drupal 8.0 and Drupal 8.1.
Yeah, there sure were. CHX actually wrote a patch that changed migrations themselves from configuration entities to be plugins. So with that big change, lots of things in Contrib didn't work. So to do custom Drupal to Drupal migrations, we basically had to re-implement that. And so that was what Mike and myself have been working on over the last little while to support custom Drupal to Drupal migrations in Drupal 8.1.
So if somebody has already jumped in and they already know all about it, how much of a difference is it for them to convert their existing code to something that works with Drupal 8.1?
It's, if they've been doing it in Drupal 8, going to Drupal 8.1 is trivial almost, you would say. There's a couple things to watch out for, but the main thing is you basically just need to rename your template files for your migration. They used to be, I think, migrate.migration and the template, the rest of the template name, but now they're going to be migrate_plus.migration. And so just with a quick rename of all your template files in your module, and you can carry on conducting your custom migrations.
And how about if I've never seen a Drupal 8 migration before, how much different is it going to be from Drupal 7 land?
The concepts are the same, but the process is entirely different. So, yeah, quite a bit different.
Everything you know is wrong.
I mean, a lot of the thinking translates, but certainly the way you do things is different in 8. But our Migrate to Drupal 8 tutorials are going to cover that in depth.
So. When's that coming out? No pressure.
We're expecting phase one of that really soon, which is going to cover the stuff that's in experimental status in core right now. And then following that up with a phase that will cover more of the contributed module space, which is, you know, the custom Drupal migrations and things like that.
Really soon, like between now and DrupalCon?
We should have the first portion of this out. Yep.
Excellent. And then you'll just continue to fill out more, kind of like Drupalize Me did with their theming series. You know, they got the
exactly.
First part out and you guys just kept coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Drupal 8, you know, the pace of development and change is like that. So we've kind of made a conscious effort to try and change the way we're producing content to allow us to do a kind of a, you know, rapidly updating things, I guess you could say.
So if somebody wants to figure out Drupal 8 Migrate, they need to get themselves a membership to Drupalize Me and learn all about it.
Yeah, that would be an excellent plan.
Soon, though. It's coming soon.
Yes.
Hey, you're going to be in New Orleans for DrupalCon. That's exciting, right?
I sure am. Yeah, I've never been to New Orleans, so I'm quite excited indeed. It'll be my second DrupalCon. So, yeah, really looking forward to it.
It'll be fun. I'll see you there.
Welcome back. We're at the Lullabot podcast, and we're talking Drupal security with Greg Kanatison and Michael Hess. Both are members of the Drupal security team.
And, you know, Greg actually wrote the book on Drupal security.
Did.
Really?
Quite literally, yeah. So, Greg, maybe that's a question for you. Is there going to be a Drupal 8 version?
Oh, good question. I'm not sure. It was an interesting process to write the book.
First, we should probably describe. The book is called Cracking Drupal. Right. It was written for Drupal 6. Still majorly applies to everything Drupal 7. So Drupal 8?
Yeah, I would say, you know, Drupal 7 was underway. And so I sort of mentioned a little bit about, you know, what had already changed with Drupal 7 at that point. But I think, you know, the things that, I don't know, this obviously hurts the book sales because people want to see the big, like, works with Drupal 7 on the cover. But the reality is that not a lot changed, and that, you know, the things that I tried to talk about were having a security mindset, how to identify and fix a cross-site scripting issue. And if you read the book and then you search for, like, how do I fix XSS in Drupal 8, like, that's going to give you the piece of information you need. So that's been the thing that's been holding me back from writing an updated version of it for Drupal 7 and Drupal 8, is that I sort of feel like 90% of the value is already in there. I should say also that the definitive guide to Drupal, which has a Drupal 7 version and I believe a Drupal 8 version, is either done or underway. But that book also covers security quite well. Pro Drupal Development has some content on security, although not as much as the definitive guide. And then there's also a white paper published by Open Concept, Mike Gifford, that has a fair amount of content sort of approaching it from a different perspective than Cracking Drupal. Cracking Drupal says, let's talk about just security inside of Drupal, whereas Mike Gifford's paper that's freely available, the PDF, is more of a, like, let's talk about all the security things going beyond just Drupal.
Tell me about that white paper. I thought you were involved with a white paper a few years ago that I thought was pretty good.
Yeah. So there's two different Drupal freely available security-oriented white paper. So one of them is it's at DrupalSecurityReport.org, I believe. And what that one is meant to do is, particularly it's focused at people who are evaluating Drupal, and whether that is, you know, somebody who's looking to bring it into their organization or somebody who is being pitched Drupal and you're a CISO or IT security person and you've just been told, hey, we just hired this consulting firm to make us a Drupal. And you're saying, well, what the heck is that?
Drupal.
Right. So the idea of the Drupal Security Report white paper is that it gives you, and it ended up being something like 14 pages, but I promise they're light on, you know, they're as concise as they can be. It's aimed to give you confidence that Drupal takes, that the Drupal project takes security seriously and has addressed the major issues that it should. So that's what the Drupal Security Report is about, is for people evaluating Drupal to gain comfort around how Drupal handles security. Now, the paper that's published by Open Concept and Mike Gifford is meant to be more of a, okay, now project's underway, maybe we're getting closer to launch, and we need to make sure that everything is done securely. And it gives you guide around that section.
There's also another white paper that Greg, I think, co-authored on PCI compliance within Drupal.
That's true. All the papers. So yeah, the PCI one is also kind of interesting because it talks about Drupal, but really it's sort of a condensed version of just what the heck is PCI anyway, and it's got a bit of a Drupal slant to it, but I think it's honestly a useful resource even if you're not using Drupal.
So PCI is paper card industry, and that's a set of standards that you have to conform if you're accepting credit cards over the web. Am I stating that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Basically, when you start accepting cards, part of your merchant agreement is that you will comply with the appropriate levels of the PCI data security standard, DSS. And so there's a set of different standards that whenever you accept a PAN, whether it's via an iframe, you know, any kind of, if those numbers are being entered on your website, then you've got to comply with PCI.
So the web form that I currently have set up to accept credit cards, I should maybe take that down.
Yes.
Maybe install a security certificate. Maybe. And if anybody wants to donate money,
I don't know about that.
So let's talk DrupalCon. So everybody here is going to DrupalCon, and that's in about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks.
And in 3.5 weeks, we're going to watch the hacker hack. Michael and Greg, tell us what we're gonna see, because I'm looking forward to it. Is it going to be like one of those TV shows where one of you's on one keyboard and one of you's on the other, and then you like trade hands halfway through and keep going? Or
I don't want to give too much away, but part of this was, you know, we've done a lot of presentations on kind of here are the major vulnerabilities, here's how you find them, here's how you fix them, and this is kind of going to take the different approach. From kind of the hacker's perspective of, okay, I found this site out there and I kind of want to get into it. Let's see how I can find these methods to get into this site. And we'll cover some of the best practices, and you know, it'll be a fun presentation. I am told we will actually have a hacker show up.
That's pretty cool. So I was going to say, I will buy both of you guys dinner if when you give your session, you actually dress like hackers. And like by that, you have to wear like hoodies with maybe like sunglasses or like long trench coats or something like that.
What color of hat will you guys be wearing?
Blue.
Oh.
Of course. Spirit Team all has blue hats.
Yeah. I think it's going to be pretty fun. I hope that it will help people to approach security from, you know, make it more approachable to people, because I think a lot of people are like, oh, you know, the security, like they have these tricks that they do. And like, that's kind of true, but it's like anything in the world, if you break it down to the basics, it's just the same techniques that any web developer uses day in and day out. It's just that we're approaching the problem from a different perspective, from the perspective of how can I, you know, basically violate that security triad. I think it's kind of a fun exercise, whether it's, you know, physical security with a house or digital security with a website, to think, okay, what if I lost my username and password? How could I break into my own website? What could I do to break into my own, you know, into my own infrastructure? And that's a, you know, a risk assessment practice that that I go through at work, you know, periodically, but is just, I think, a really useful tool when you're doing a code review on somebody else's code, or you're looking at a module and thinking about how to use it on your site. Think about, okay, how could an attacker use this to take over my site? And that's the mentality that I think is really useful when you're trying to evaluate a code, a website, anything for whether it's secure or not.
So are you expecting live demos?
I don't know if we may pre-record some of them just to be safe. Live demos
are always fun.
Yes. Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. Fun means something else, but.
So, what's your date and time slot for your session?
We're getting it over early. It is on Tuesday at 3:45.
Tuesday is the first real day of sessions for DrupalCon. So, 3:45 in the afternoon. Then you'll be Then you'll be relaxed and get to enjoy the rest of the conference, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I hear there's actually going to be a funeral procession for Drupal 6 on Thursday night.
Wow, that's beautiful.
I'm not even making that up. Yeah, I think that's pretty awesome. And of course, the procession is going to, I think, I don't know, leave the convention center and go to a bar. So that kind of fits out perfectly.
Sounds like New Orleans. So
I've seen some beautiful photos of New Orleans funeral processions. It's a big deal.
Interesting. Mm. Cool.
Well, definitely looking forward to hearing your session. Guys, do you have anything else that maybe you want to talk about Drupal security? Greg, any other thoughts?
I think, you know, one thing that's on my mind, whenever there's a new release of Drupal, adopting it is a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a risk, right? I think that people are always like, well, is it stable enough? Is it feature rich enough with all the contribs? Are they all there yet? And for people who are committing to Drupal 8 now, I just would give some extra encouragement to, you know, you're you're going to have to invest a little bit more in those projects than you might in a Drupal 7 project. And one of the places that I think is important to invest is in security. So Drupal 7 has had a large number of private security audits that have been run on it. And the community as a whole benefits from those because, generally speaking, when one of those happens, the vulnerabilities that are identified in community code, those vulnerabilities get reported back to the security team or to the module maintainer if it's not in the purview of the security team. And so that's an important process for basically hardening, for improving the security of Drupal and finding vulnerabilities. And it's not a flawless process, but it's a good process. So Drupal 7, that's already happened. Drupal 8, it's happened somewhat, but not nearly to the extent that it did with Drupal 7. So I would just encourage people as part of adopting Drupal 8, keep your eyes open for, in particular, security bugs.
Greg, do you have one thing that you could tell people that they should do regarding their Drupal website for security? One practical tip to help somebody out.
this one weird trick will eliminate your vulnerability. just one. Can I give three?
Sure.
There's three modules that I really like for Drupal security. And those are the security review module, the paranoia module, and the two-factor authentication module. Those three modules take care of what are, you know, some of the most common problems that are actually exploited to take over a Drupal site. I mean, aside from just staying up to date, which is probably the most common problem that gets exploited, but I think for a site that is up to date, those are the next things to do to dramatically improve the security of your site.
So you said the security review module, the paranoia module, and two-factor authentication.
And those are all, don't require any external services. They're all freely available on Drupal.org. Download it, install it, read the instructions, configure it, and within an hour, your site will be more secure.
We'll link to those within our show notes if anybody wants to go download those.
Michael?
I would second two-factor authentication. You know, the other thing I would do is I would review your permissions tabs and just make sure your permissions are sane. If you've got someone else in your office that does Drupal work and they haven't seen your permissions tab, maybe make them look over it. Lots of people go in there and they're clicking a little too quickly sometimes, and permissions get assigned to the wrong user groups, or, you know, worse, you give, you know, administer site configuration to anonymous, and, well, that's bad.
The permissions matrix of Doom.
Which is why I bring it up. Two-factor authentication, you know, it the module is written by a security team member. We actually did put that on a site. We gave out the admin username and password and put some money behind it if someone could actually log in. And, of course, the background behind two-factor authentication is you log in with username and password, and then you have to have some other mechanisms to log in as. And in this case, it's, you know, typically a QR code we give you, which generates a one-time token that you enter in. And no one was able to use that. We do use it on Drupal.org. So if you have administrative rights or elevated rights on Drupal.org, you're required to use two-factor authentication to log in with. It's really easy to set up, and it really does provide a pretty solid extra layer of security. And then the last thing, which is kind of obvious, but I'm going to say it anyhow, you know, update your site. If you've got that little red notice that shows up on your site, well, first of all, make sure you have update status enabled. Then, if you have that little red notice that shows up on your site, update.
So would I tell my mom that the emails she gets from her website telling her that it's out of date means that her website is still up and that it's a good thing? Maybe that's not the best suggestion for her.
It's upsending spam if you're not careful.
Sorry, Mom, I'll get on that
site.
Or leaking documents.
Yeah, or leaking documents.
Yep.
Awesome. Michael, do you have any final thoughts?
No. Thank you guys for doing this.
No, thank you.